Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at UAA, where the National Wildlife Federation is hosting a forum with three Alaskan physicians on the health effects of climate change. On KSKA.org, you can listen to the discussion in its entirety, but this hour, KSKA presents one of the three panelists, Mike Brubaker, co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Health at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Mike Brubaker on the health effects of climate change is coming up next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
Well, hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Pat Lav, and I'm with the National Wildlife Federation office right here in Anchorage. And it's a pleasure to welcome you to this event tonight on climate change and human health. You know, the impacts of climate change run a broad spectrum, and I think the human health implications is one set of concerns that probably hasn't gotten quite as much airtime as some others. So as part of NWF's ongoing work on climate change, I thought it was a good idea to put an event like this together if we could. I'm going to turn it over quickly to Steve Cleary, who really put this event together, my colleague. But I'll just say by way of context that it's a top priority of the National Wildlife Federation to address climate change and first and foremost by enacting national legislation, which is under discussion right now in Congress. The House has already passed a version of climate change legislation, and the consideration is in the Senate right now. And so in terms of jumping to sort of the end of the program, when you might be, after hearing a lot of information about this aspect of climate change, you might be wondering what you can do. I would let you know that it's very much under live consideration in the Senate right now. Both of our senators here from Alaska are involved and engaged in the issue and would benefit tremendously from hearing from their constituents. So if you haven't already contacted your senator, now's a good time to do that while the debate is live. And also, if you're a health professional, Steve has been reaching out around a letter that would is a slightly off to the side of the climate change legislation itself. But as you may have heard, Senator Murkowski has introduced a resolution that would prevent the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, from regulating carbon pollution at all. And that sort of that EPA regulation is based on an EPA finding that carbon pollution, in fact, presents a threat to human health and the environment. So what Senator Murkowski has proposed to do would have the effect of vetoing the EPA finding that carbon pollution presents a challenge or can be harmful to human health. So again, part of what that did for me was raise the need to educate and bring forward the soundness really of the EPA's finding and that climate change really does have these human health implications, which I think you'll hear about tonight. I understand the public radio is here, which is great for me because I'm told I have a radio face, but I'm very glad that to see the interest in here tonight, and I'll turn it over to Steve.
Well, thanks, Pat, and I'd like to echo Pat's thank you to all of you for coming in on this beautiful night. On behalf of the National Wildlife Federation, I'd like to welcome you to this forum on the health effects of climate change. I'm going to introduce our three speakers. We've got quite a panel for you tonight. We'll save the questions till the end, so if you do come up with a question, please write it down or remember it until the end, and we'll bring the speakers up for a Q&A after they've all had a chance to present. I do need to disclose that our speakers, though they are presenting tonight, do not necessarily hold the opinions of the National Wildlife Federation. And with that, it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Jeffrey DeMaine. Dr. DeMaine is the director and founder of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska. Dr. Demain is board certified in allergy, immunology, and pediatrics. He is an associate professor at the University of Washington School of Medicine and adjunct clinical professor here at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Dr. Demain is a nationally recognized speaker and has been published in numerous peer-reviewed medical journals and has also co-authored a textbook entitled Cutaneous Allergy. Dr. Demain served on the Alaska Governor's Subcabinet for Climate Change Adaption Advisory Group and has a particular interest in the role of climate change and the impact on human health. A longtime Alaskan, Dr. Demain is an avid fly fisherman and outdoorsman. Please help me welcome Dr. Jeff Demain.
I'd like to second the appreciation of you being here tonight on such a beautiful evening. Hopefully this is going to be great information for you to think about, look at, and come up with some of your own questions and concerns, and we can have some very nice dialogue afterwards. My task tonight is to address, we're going to do different sections, and I'm going to be looking principally at allergic and respiratory impacts of climate change. So I'd like to make some disclosures. First of all, I think what's most important is I'm not an expert on global warming. I'm not a climatologist. I'm a physician, and I work in as an allergist immunologist, the environment's very important. So I think a lot of what we do is make observations and then try to see what are associated with those observations. I am involved with some research with pharmaceutical companies, and I do speak for two pharmaceutical companies periodically. None of those are going to have any impact on this talk. So climate change, my other task is to introduce climate change a bit. So climate change is truly happening. There's scientific consensus of that, that it's occurring. The planet is warming. Regardless of some of the variables, it's certainly happening. And there's certainly some impact of greenhouse gases, which include carbon dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, water vapor, methane gas. All of these are significant contributing factors. Greenhouse gases trap solar energy near the Earth's surface, then result in climate change or global warming. Now, this is a cartoon, and this is about as scientific as I'm going to get regarding explaining global warming. But as the sun penetrates the atmosphere to the Earth, it warms the Earth. If we didn't have the sun penetrating the Earth, we wouldn't be here because it would be a frozen planet. However, a significant portion of that radiation is reflected back into above the atmosphere, and that's because when it hits water or primarily when it hits ice, it's reflected back. If it hits land or if it hits water, it tends to be absorbed. So two things are happening. Number one, we're losing some of our ice fields and sea ice, so we're getting more absorption and less reflection. Secondly, what is reflected back are striking particles, what's referred to as greenhouse gases, and then it's as a result being reflected back to the Earth. So we're absorbing and maintaining radiation on the planet that's at a higher level than what we ever have in the past. So some issues about climate change is that global warming or global temperatures are increasing. The planet has increased at 0.74 degrees Celsius over the past 50 years. Winter temperatures and nighttime temperatures have increased greater than that. That's about 1 degree Celsius throughout the planet. However, in the polar region, we've increased over 2 degrees Celsius. So we're actually rising at 3 to 4 times the rate of the planet in the circumpolar region of the globe. The projected temperatures by 2100 range between 1.4 and 5.8 degrees Celsius in addition to where we are today. And this range varies, and I'm going to show you some reasons why, but it's based on variables, models, how we adapt to this and what happens. I mean, we can only do our best guess, so to speak, is what's going to happen in the future, but we base that future on what's happened in the past and what's going on today. These variables are reviewed and they're scrubbed and they're studied and they're put into really smart computers and smart brains, and they come up with projections, and these are done in many countries throughout the world. It is felt that there's going to be a significant increase in the higher latitudes and over land. Now, there's been controversies about climate change, certainly in the last 6 months. And right before the IPCC meeting in Copenhagen, there was a big debate about Dr. Mann at Penn State. And I wanted just to bring this out and show you where the debate is. This is called the hockey stick debate. And this is what's happened over the last 1,000 years. You see that climate and temperatures go up and down, just like weather goes up and down. Because we have a warm Sunday doesn't mean that climate change is stopped. But there's variability and there's a standard deviation. But over the last, over the last 100 years, there's been a dramatic increase in the temperature change. So what this what happened with Dr. Mann is they kind of scrubbed out some of this standard deviation and made this really nice pretty line and made it look pretty straight, which it's not. And that would really raise some discussion that, you know, was probably some statistical liberties taken there. But the point is this cartoon has been used over and over again, showing that we do have warming periods. And this is the period where the Vikings left England and went to Greenland because the sea ice melted and because the crops failed because of drought in Britain. And then this is where we went through the little ice age where the Thames River froze. And now we're coming out of the little ice age. But what we're seeing here today and here where we are is that we're seeing CO2 levels and temperature levels rising at a very alarming rate, and nothing that's ever been seen or recorded over the past 800,000 years. So let's take away some of that data and let's say, let's look at something new. Well, this is NASA's data. It's kind of funny. NASA's data shows a pretty similar trend where we're seeing temperatures are definitely rising. And if you listen to, you know, media or radio, you'll hear that, oh, well, there's, you know, we're seeing cooling temperatures throughout. Well, if you look globally over the past decade, 100% of the entire planet, 10 of the past 10 years have been the warmest on record. If you look at the northern hemisphere, 50% of the globe, 10 of the past 10 years have been the warmest on record. If you look at the northern hemisphere at the 30-degree latitude and north, that's from the southern part of the United States north, 10 of the past 10 years have been the warmest on record. If you look at only the land mass of the planet, which makes up 30% of the mass of the planet, then 10 of the 10 years have, or actually 9 of the 10 years have been the warmest on record. If you look at the continental United States, the lower 48 states alone, which represents 1.6% of the planet, then 3 of the past 10 years have been the warmest on record. So it depends on what your reference point is. So when someone says, we're seeing actually things are cooling, you should ask them what their reference point is, whether it's 1.6% of the globe or whether it's 100% of the globe. So I think that's an important concept to take away. Now, the World Health Organization has reported that over the past 30 years, they estimate 150,000 deaths per year as a result, direct result of climate change, and 5 million disrupted lives every year. And both Joe and Mike are going to go over that in great detail. And this is associated with extreme heat, drought, storms, floods, changes in air and water quality, and malnutrition due to crop failures, transmission of disease, and change in insect patterns. And I think that's particularly interesting. That's a very nice slide by Jonathan Patz that I've borrowed. And what Jonathan Patz has done is really kind of depicted some of the health impacts that have already being seen throughout the world and impacts that are occurring. I'm going to address a few of them. I'm going to look at air pollution and aeroallergens, and I'm going to look at some insect-related disease. These other impacts are going to be addressed by the next speakers. So the circumpolar region will continue to illuminate the impacts of climate change more apparent than other places on the planet. Over the next 100 years, for example, 90% of the historic tundra of Alaska is projected to be forested. This is going to be replaced by forest. There's going to be dramatic changes in the ecosystem, and there's going to be certainly extinction of plants and animals, or some plants and animals. In addition, there's going to be an increase in insects and pathogen may result in epidemics of plant disease and insect attacks. Now, this was actually published in 2004, so remember that, because we're going to talk about this again. Now, is there an asthma and allergy epidemic around the world? The answer is yes. Over the past 50 years, virtually every country in the world has reported significant increases in asthma and allergy. This is looking at asthma alone. This, by the way, is Australia, where we're looking at almost a 45% of the population with asthma. This is New Zealand, where about 35% of the population has asthma. So again, very significant. Again, every country in the world is really reporting increases. What about allergies? What about environmental allergies, sneezing, runny nose, itchy eyes? Well, indeed, we're seeing the same type of patterns, that since we've become an industrial nation, we've seen a significant increase in oculonasal symptoms as well as respiratory symptoms. So there's a lot of reasons for this, or a lot of speculation and hypothesis for this. So some of those factors are indeed industrialization, changes in antigen exposure, and that's antigen would be like birch pollen, for example. Changes in childhood infections, changes in home construction, changes in activity, or really the lack thereof activity, changes in dietary habits, and then maybe smoking exposure in infants. And you could probably put in there other things like nutritional issues, including vitamin D, etc. So there's a lot of theories, a lot of discussion, and we could literally spend the entire night just talking about these theories alone. The honest truth is these variables all probably interface, and they're all playing a significant role. We're going to focus on these variables right now during my talk. So we're going to look at industrialization and how it has impacted antigen exposure. In addition to that, we're going to look at how industrialization has impacted climate change. This is another slide. This is a slide from JAMA. And again, it's nice to see paradigms. Sometimes it helps when you start looking at it. What we're going to be looking at is really upper and lower respiratory disease or allergic disease and the association with air pollution and pollen production and how it does interrelate with some of the industrial changes, industrialization of the world. Now, when we talked about CO2 level or temperature levels. CO2 is very important. CO2 precedes temperature. So what you can see is, again, since over the past 1,000 years, CO2 levels have been really pretty steady until we reached an industrialization of the Western world. At the industrialization, we had a dramatic rise from a CO2 level of about 280 to an average CO2 level about 370 currently. So again, when you look at CO2 concentrations and overlie temperature variations, you can see that those patterns look quite similar. We're going to talk about air quality, and with air quality, some of the issues are going to revolve around pollens and how those have changed. We're also going to talk about pollution. We're going to talk about particulate matter. We're going to talk about forest fires. It's interesting to note that forest fires are significantly on a rise with permafrost melting, as Mike is going to discuss, that you're seeing more tundra fires. In between 2004 and 2005, there was over 11 million acres burned in Alaska. Usually we have 500,000 or 600,000 acres per year. So there's an awful lot changing. As glaciers recede, we're seeing more glacial silt in the air. So all the impacts that look big and how can that affect me, it does. It certainly affects the respiratory involvement. So let's first talk about molds. And actually, I'm on a task force looking at this with our American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. And there's really not a lot of literature. There's not been a lot of studies looking at mold. And mold is not exactly carbon dependent like what we see with pollens. However, studies have shown that there are increases in mold sporulation as well as increases in mold mycelia growth. This is a retrospective study by Hollins looking at mold concentrations over 27 years. And they did show that with rising CO2, there were more days with high levels of cladosporium exceeding allergen concentration, or in other words, where you feel sick. And that did seem to correlate with temperature and CO2. There was another study. This was actually a controlled study where they monitored the mycelia growth, or the growth of the mold itself, not the sporulation. And it showed by increasing or doubling the CO2 level from 400 to 800 parts per million, it increased the mycelia an additional 40%. So even though it may not be a carbon-dependent growth, it does seem to have an impact. Now, what about pollens? Now, pollens is a different story. There's hard, solid, fast data that pollens are impacted. The correlation is really is no doubt that it's occurring. CO2 concentration, like I said, has increased 29% since industrial times. It's expected to double again by 2100 based on the IPCC projection. In a CO2-rich atmosphere, as a Dr. Paul Epstein from Harvard, a friend of mine, he's done some great work looking at ragweed. And what he did is he used 12 greenhouses. He planted ragweed in the greenhouses, and he controlled all the variables and only modified one, and that was the CO2 level. And he took CO2 from 350 to 700, and what he found is that the ragweed pollen increased by 61%, the biomass increased 63%, or the weight of the plant, there was increased plant height and an increased seed mass. So in other words, the plant significantly responded to only the change in one variable, and that's CO2. Now, Dr. Ziska from Duke University is who actually developed this model looking at greenhouse. And I think this is a very interesting study because what he did, again, they're looking at ragweed. What he did was looked at pre-industrial CO2, current CO2, so pre-industrial at 280, current levels at 370, and projected 2100 CO2 at 600. And what he showed is that from the pre-industrial level to current, there was 132% increase in the plant biomass or the pollen biomass produced by the ragweed, plus an increase in the height. When he went from the current level at 370 to 600, there was an additional 90% increase. So if you look from pre-industrial time at 280 to what is projected from 2800, then you have almost a 200% increase in the amount of pollen that's being produced by ragweed. And that's a popular model in this country. Dr. Ziska then said, well, what happens in the real world? Let's take it out of the greenhouse. And what he did is in Baltimore, Maryland, he looked at urban, suburban versus rural. So what he was able to do is put plants, potted ragweed plants, did nothing to change it at all, but monitored CO2 levels from 2000 to 2001 and found that in the urban area, CO2 was 30% higher than in the rural area. Also found that the temperature was 18 degrees higher in the urban versus the rural area. And what he found when he was studying these is there was a significant increase. In fact, comparing ragweed growth and pollen production, there was 189% increase in the pollen production in the urban area where it was higher CO2 and higher temperature compared to the rural area. So that's what we also refer to as a heat island effect. So that was a very, very interesting study. And this is another way of depicting it. So this is the y-axis, the x-axis. The x-axis is CO2 level. The y-axis is temperature. And the yellow and the green bars, you're seeing that the pollen level is fairly low. And that's in the cooler temperatures and the lesser CO2. But as we increase in temperature and as we increase in CO2, you can see those bars significantly rise. And the red bar represents inner city Baltimore. And this is pollen production with no other change. Nothing except for the location of the plants. So very interesting work. This is another way of looking at the same data. And what this is showing us again is in the suburb and rural and urban area, much higher levels. And also of their pollen cycle began significantly earlier. So it also affects that. So pollen cycles are starting earlier and we're seeing higher levels than we were seeing in the rural. They call this semi-rural, which was a park. This is a table that I won't go into. It just reemphasizes what I just said. Now, what about non-pollinating plants? What about poison ivy? We don't have that here, but it'd be very interesting to study pushkin maybe because we have the same type of issue. This is a study that was done at Duke University. And again, they looked at poison ivy in a controlled environment with CO2 levels at 570 versus 370, which is our current level. And what they found is that the poison ivy increased, basically doubled its growth compared to the lower CO2 level. So the physical growth of the vine went from 75%, which was the baseline growth, to 150%. Which is the high CO2 growth. Interestingly, in addition to that, they were able to demonstrate that the urushiol, or the toxin in poison ivy, got significantly more toxic. What it means is that the unsaturated urushiol is what causes the blistering, not the saturated. So what we saw was a significant change in that, and that made it a more toxic plant. Kind of interestingly, the pollens have also been demonstrated have a similar effect, and I'm going to show you that in a moment. Looking at tree pollination, birch, actually, Alaska is the highest level of birch in the world. Most of the studies looking at birch pollen have been done throughout Europe and Finland, Scandinavia. In fact, these are several studies I've just listed. One is from Poland, another one is from Denmark, another one from Spain. And what they've been able to show with birch pollen is there's a significant increase in birch pollen cycles as far as the onset of when they're going to pollinate, as well as the level of pollen, and it's based on temperature primarily, and to a lesser degree precipitation, but primarily temperature. And this is another study. This was a study from Finland, and they looked at birch pollen, and what they're measuring here is a specific protein in birch pollen. That's the one that makes you sick. That's the one that makes you wheeze and gives you runny nose and itchy eyes. It's called BETV1. So again, in a CO2-enriched environment, what they were able to show is a significant increase in the percentage of BETV1 compared to baseline, and that did reach statistical significance. So we can look at the impact on aerobiology and what's going on. So what we're interested in, we're looking at CO2, increased greenhouse gases, increased temperature. They seem to be the factors that are playing the biggest role. They increase the pollen amount. There's a stronger allergenicity, earlier pollen season, longer pollen season, altered distribution, and changes in the germination rate, but also changes in the toxicity of the plants. And if you take away the human factor, which still remains some debate to some, not a debate to me, but it's still occurring. So regardless of why, it's there. So we have to recognize it and adapt. So then you say, well, how does this affect humans? Well, this is a beautiful paper that was just presented 2 weeks ago in New Orleans, and I was there. This was at the international meeting, and this was from Genoa, Italy. And what they looked at was a 27-year study looking at the pollen, specifically birch pollen, cypress pollen, olive pollen, grass pollen, and weed pollen. They monitored those pollens over 27 years, and then they correlated that with how patients did as far as allergies, developing pollen allergies versus dust mite. Dust mite didn't change, so they said that can be our control. And then they looked at variables. They looked at direct radiation from the sun, temperature change, number of days greater than 30 degrees Celsius, humidity, and rainfall. So what they found was there was a significant increase in pollen trends. Over that 27 years, trees pollinated 80 days earlier than they did 27 years ago. Weeds pollinated 30 days earlier than they did 20 years ago. There was an increase in the amount of tree pollen, grass pollen, and weed pollen. And then they looked at the number of patients as far as sensitivity. And they found that there was a significant increase in patients that developed sensitivity to pollen allergies. So the prevalence of pollen sensitivity went up, while at the same time there was absolutely no change in dust mite, which suggests greater levels of exposure and more potent allergen resulting in an immune reaction. Then they said, let's look at the climate correlation between the patients and the pollen and see. When they looking at those five variables, they found that the direct radiation measurement had the single greatest association with this finding. Also, increased temperature and the number of days greater than 30 also played a significant role. They found no correlation with humidity and rainfall. Now, they weren't measuring CO2 directly, but we now know that temperature is an indirect measurement of that. So their conclusion was the progressive climate change with increased temperatures may modify the global pollen load and may influence the rate of allergic sensitization over long periods. And I think we have to all understand and believe and realize that there are many variables out there. I think some variables are more logical to study than others. You can't study everything. We don't live in an acrylic box. But I think we have to make some correlations and be reasonable. I mentioned before about projections. How do we project these things? They're done by really very complex models that are designed into very complex computers and also with the use of satellite imagery. One of the programs is here at UAF. It's run by Dr. Scott Rupp. It's called SNAP, or the Scenario Network Alaska Program. And again, a very respected model or variable indicator in the world. And what they're looking at here, Scott is looking at trees. Conifer trees like spruce and hemlock are not allergenic. They don't make you sneeze and wheeze. You may see them, it may mess your car up, but it's not going to make you sneeze and wheeze. The brown represents deciduous trees like birch and cottonwood and willow. And you can see on this graph that the conifers are the predominant tree source in Alaska compared to a much lower level of deciduous. Well, what's been happening, in fact, as of about 1990, we're seeing a significant rise in those pollen-producing deciduous trees and a significant decrease in conifers. And this is projected to continue to a point where the conifers, the evergreens, are going to be at a very low level, certainly by 2100, where we're going to see a continued significant rise in the deciduous trees. Now, a lot of things are affecting this. The disease, like the spruce bark beetle, is affecting it, which has been linked to climate change. Also, fires are changing it. The deciduous trees are going to be the first to regrow. So there's a lot of factors changing here, including the ecosystem in the tundra, like I was telling you earlier. So when permafrost is melting away, you're going to have new type of flora and fauna taking its place. So what about air pollution in Alaska? We don't have a lot of factories. We have one coal plant that I know of, or one coal mine that I know of, that is active. Well, this is smoke. So I was riding in one of my friend's planes taking photos of the flora and fauna and fireweed. And actually, this cloudiness is not just his dirty windshield, but the smoke. This is from the Galena fire. This is Fairbanks during the Boundary Fire, and you can see that's just pretty amazing as far as pollution. The very same location, tremendous difference. So when you look at the air quality issues, we have tremendous problems with air quality issues, particularly in the interior. In fact, purple, which is Fairbanks, is here. This is unhealthy, very hazardous, and nobody should be outside without a mask. Honestly, when it comes into an orange range, if you have respiratory disease, you should leave. So you can see almost the entire interior was in the very unhealthy or hazardous range during this period of time. This was in 2004 when one fire consumed over 537,000 acres. And again, between 2004 and 2005, there was over 11 million acres burned in Alaska. Now, what about pollution in other cities? Los Angeles has the pride of being the most polluted city in the United States, although no city in the United States makes the top 10 in the world. All 10 in the world are from China. This is Atlanta, another city with significant problems with pollution. And actually, this is Anchorage. And we have our own issues, not just from forest fires, but also from car pollution. When we have a low pressure that hangs over the city, we're surrounded on three sides by mountains. And if you don't have a breeze, it's going to accumulate. So we see air pollution, heat waves, exacerbation of chronic disease, extreme precipitation events like hurricanes, waterborne disease, and increased pollen can occur as a result of some of these air quality changes. Shift gears a bit. I'm going to leave the insect-borne disease and waterborne disease to Dr. McLaughlin, but I'm going to let that be my entry, that insects do play a role when it comes to allergies, and that's the part that I'm discussing. This was interesting to me. Alaska's really never had any stinging caterpillars. I got pretty excited when I saw an article in the paper with people getting rashes when they're picking berries, and they found this caterpillar. We promptly identified it as a tussock moth, which is a caterpillar limited to the Pacific Northwest, usually the Oregon and Washington, and it was found in forest and where the timber was being cut, and the workers were getting these venomous spines in their eyes and in their lungs and developing very significant sensitivity. The surface of this caterpillar has about 2 million spines, and all those spines have venom. So if you rub against it, it causes a grid-like rash and a condition called lepidopterism, which can actually be very serious. You can have anaphylaxis, including fatal anaphylaxis. Well, in addition to that, in 2006, it was noted that in Fairbanks there was a significant increase in the number of yellow jackets in Fairbanks. In fact, it was estimated there was a tenfold increase, and this was by a biologist. In fact, with just three little soda bottle nests, he captured almost 4,000 yellow jackets in his yard. Following that, he destroyed 9 or 10 aerial nests and estimated killing 12,000 yellow jackets just on his property alone. So during this time, there was a lot of sporting events canceled. I mean, people were being stung. This was a big problem. In addition to that, for the first time, we had two deaths within 4 weeks of each other as a result of yellow jacket stings. Both of these individuals died of a systemic reaction called anaphylaxis, which is a severe, potentially fatal, in this case, unfortunately, fatal event as a result of those stings, which brought up a question. You know, why did, you know, first of all, Dr. Gessner and I reported this in the Alaska Epidemiology Bulletin. And then with a group of very, very great dedicated researchers, including Dr. Gessner, Dr. McLaughlin, who you'll hear for third, Dr. Derek Sykes, an entomologist at UAF, and Dr. Tim Foote in Fairbanks, we decided to look at this. So what we first looked at was in the Fairbanks data. We saw that there were, we monitored this from about 2090, and we noticed a pretty flat line as far as people going to the emergency department for stings. And then in 2006, the year I'm talking about, there was a dramatic increase, in fact, a fourfold increase. And this was thought to be what we call an outbreak year. So this was a fairly isolated event. But then we took a look at the Medicaid database, and we looked at my clinic. Now, I'm the only allergy immunology clinic in the state. We have 5 satellite clinics. And so we looked at how many patients are referred to our clinic because of severe sting-related events. And what we saw was a very significant trend over a period of about 8 years, where the number of referrals kept getting higher and higher. In fact, there was a significant enough trend, had a p-value of less than 0.001. Then, with the help of Dr. McLaughlin, we looked at 134,000 patients that are participants in the Medicaid database. So this is certainly not a biased database. And what we did is looked at people that reported for medical care as a result of a sting, an insect sting. And over that decade, we saw a significant rise, whether it was the primary diagnosis or whether it was any diagnosis at all, again, with a very significant trend of less than 0.001. And then we said, okay, well, this is pretty significant. This looks like it's been increasing, not just in 2006. In fact, in the Medicaid database in 2006, there was a drop. It's kind of interesting. So we said, well, is there any correlation? So we looked at some climate variables. Well, one of the things we did is divide the state up into six regions, although this was already divided up into six regions: the northern region, the interior, the Anchorage, Matsu, southwest, Gulf Coast, and southeast. And we looked at the major community within each of those in those areas. And we looked at the temperature changed in those areas. And then we looked at the number of stings per capita in those areas. So as you can see, if in Barrow, there was an annual temperature rise of 3.8. That's pretty impressive, 3.8 degrees Fahrenheit. An average winter increase of 6.1. In Bethel, 3.7, average winter of 6.9. Fairbanks, 3.6, average winter of 8.1. Anchorage, 3.4 overall increase with a 7.2 degree Fahrenheit increase during the winter. Juneau, 3.6 in the annual with a 6.8 degree increase in the winter. But if you look at Kodiak or the Gulf Coast, it was only a 1.5 degree Fahrenheit rise and only a 1.5 degree Fahrenheit rise in the winter. Then we look at the incidence of stings, and we see that from Barrow, it went from 16 to 119, and this is a per capita. It was based on per 10,000. In the Bethel, it was 62 to 133. And these are very significant rises. In Barrow, it was a 626% increase, 114% in Bethel, 53% in Fairbanks, 47% in Anchorage. In Juneau, a 27% increase. In Kodiak, or Gulf region, only 11%. So when we take a little closer look at that, we find that all these areas met strong, powerful statistical relevance or significance, with the exception of Kodiak. And Kodiak is the only one that did not have significant rises in summertime, in overall annual temperature or winter temperature. So we feel, and it's also interesting to note, Kodiak had the highest incidence of stings at 437 per cap per 10,000, and they only went up to 487. So it had the highest number of stings, and it had the highest temperature when this study began. So we did feel that there was a significant correlation with a rise in temperature and its correlation with the increase in the number of stings. So we did agree that in Fairbanks, there was that fourfold rise probably represents an outbreak year. And one of the thoughts by Dr. Sykes, the entomologist, was that increasing temperatures in Fairbanks result in increased snowfall. Snowfall protects hibernaculum, the queens overwinter, and as a result of that, you have more nests that are going to develop. However, in our clinic, it seemed that our trend was pretty linear, and so was the trend from the Medicaid database. And we could not explain these significant rises based on only a 6.4% increase in population during the same time. And I want to remind you, in 2004, one of the predictions was an increase in insect attacks. This is the first paper looking at insect attacks, actually. So it's kind of interesting that NASA's predictions came true. Now, we haven't gone back to look at the Medicaid database, but I would certainly like to look at Dr. McLaughlin and ask if we can do that and see what's happened by 2010. I did take a look at the end of December in iClinic and showed that actually the rate of a referral continues to rise. So our trend has not changed. Our trend continues to go up. So the distribution of arthropods have been seen throughout the world. It's not just Hymenoptera or yellow jacket that I showed here, but arthropods are very temperature sensitive, and they're going to move into areas of opportunity. Mosquitoes have been monitored throughout the world, and they've been increasing in latitude and increasing in altitude as a result of climate change. The beetle plague forest, not only in Alaska, but in the lower 48 and in Europe, has been linked to stress association with the forest. We're looking at Lepidoptera, not just the stinging caterpillars in Alaska, but in Britain, they've been studying 65 species of butterflies and their northern migration in correlation with climate change. And then ticks, especially in Sweden, the Ixodes tick has been the model in Sweden for climate change. So again, we're going to the mosquito issue is certainly going to be discussed more by Dr. McLaughlin, but this is something that's not really new in the world. It's new for us. So in Alaska, do the observable changes predict what is to come? And are Hymenoptera another indicated species or bellwether of climate change? And obviously, we don't know that. I think we need to look and observe and consider these variables and consider these as markers. So Alaska and the circumpolar regions certainly bear watching because we're seeing an acceleration far beyond what the globe is seeing. So with that, I'd like to turn this over to Mike Brubaker to discuss what's going on regionally and also to Joe McLaughlin, who is going to discuss what the state's response is. So thank you very much.
It's my pleasure to introduce Mike Brubaker. Mike specializes in assessing environmental and public health conditions in rural and Arctic communities. In particular, he focuses on effects resulting from pollution, development, and climate change. Michael was born in Juneau and raised in Anchorage. He received his bachelor's degree in biology from St. Lawrence University and a master's in environmental management from the University of San Francisco. His rural health work began as a Peace Corps volunteer in Hungary in 1995, where he advised local governments on water and sanitation infrastructure and cleanup of pollution of abandoned Soviet military sites. Other international work has included technical assistance to Russian indigenous communities in Chukotka and Kamchatka related to environmental contamination and traditional food safety. From 1998 to 2008, he was the Community Services Director for the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association, a regional tribal health organization. He supervised public safety, economic development, natural resource, energy and environmental health programs for 12 communities in Southwest Alaska. In his current work with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, Mr. Brubaker assesses vulnerability to climate change in communities statewide. He co-founded the Center for Climate and Health and focuses on health research and appropriate development that encourages safe, healthy, and sustainable Alaska communities. Please help us welcome Mike Brubaker.
And thanks, everybody, for coming this evening. I work for Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. It's kind of a mouthful, but what we really are is the tribal health organization for the wing for statewide for Alaska. It's an interesting place to work, partially because of the comprehensive approach that the tribal health system takes to deal with health care in Alaska. That includes not only the Alaska Native Medical Center, but also environmental health and engineering projects around the state, and also the various public health, preventive health, and also community health efforts that we call our community health program. But before working at ANTHC, I had the opportunity to work for 10 years on the regional level for another tribal health organization in the Aleutian and Pribilof region. And it was a great job because it provided me with an opportunity to travel from one end of the Aleutian chain and back many times. And while I was making those trips, I began to hear the observations of local residents about really strange and unprecedented incidents that were happening all over the Aleutian region. In Nelson Lagoon, people stopped buying snow machines entirely because they just no longer had enough snow in the winter to need them. In the community of Sandpoint, which is further down on the peninsula, they were so inundated with salmon shark that they actually had to close some of their salmon fisheries. And in the Pribilof Islands, they were actually going out, and residents were coming to Anchorage and buying insect repellent for the first time because they'd never had an overwinter population of mosquitoes, but they had established themselves. So all of these different changes together began to raise questions in the minds of the health leadership in the Aleutian region. They wanted to know, were these related to climate change? If so, what were some of the potential health effects? And what were we going to do about it? Well, at the same time, the same kinds of questions were being asked by health leadership across the state of Alaska. And it compelled the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to develop the Center for Climate and Health. And what we do is try to improve the capacity of the tribal health system and Alaska communities to identify and address health effects associated with climate change. So the tribal health system, who is involved with building, just as the state is, building water and sanitation infrastructure, and siting solid waste facilities and building clinics and providing health care along with the regional organizations, wanted to have some kind of a process where we could look at the community level and determine what kinds of changes were occurring, whether they were climate-related, and what it means for health. So the take-home I'd like for all of you guys to have this evening is, first of all, a little bit more awareness about what some of these climate change to health mechanisms are and how to identify them,
because it's not just happening on the North Slope or in the Aleutians, but I think you'll recognize more and more, and we all are, that there are things happening throughout Alaska and to people in urban settings and in rural settings as well. But also that climate change is affecting communities in many ways. Specific mechanisms are not well understood. Some of the work that's being done by Jeff DeMaine and others is really beginning to be landmark as far as understanding what is happening with insects and with allergies, but there's a whole array of other issues that we really don't understand very well. But we do understand that communities are vulnerable, and those mechanisms are well documented not only in Alaska, but in other parts of the Arctic and around the world. Participatory research works very well in small, remote, rural communities, partially because we're very limited by the amount of information that's available, by the types of data, whether it has to do with climate or whether it has to do with health. But we benefit from the fact that you have a lot of good observational skills, that you have a community that you can easily get to know and understand the different moving parts, and that you have able and interested partners at the local level as well, especially in the health community. And that by better understanding impacts, we can begin to develop responses that protect community health. So what are some of these climate change health effects in the Alaska context? The definition that we use in our program is outcomes resulting from climate change that either positively or negatively affect community health or health infrastructure. So health is not biased. If there is a change in season that has a positive effect on local residents and their mental health, for example, we want to be able to recognize that as well as anything that would be a negative outcome. And this is how we categorize in our community assessment process. This is how we categorize the different health categories. First of all, health effects related to disease, either acute disease, as is some of the things that Jeff was referring to, or chronic disease. Chronic disease, usually we're dealing with these kinds of issues, changes in lifestyle or changes in diet. Are climate impacts affecting rates of injury? I already mentioned food safety, but food safety and security are also very important categories in the assessment process. And water safety and security and other types of health-related infrastructure. And lastly, but perhaps most importantly, the type of health effects that occur really before any others do, and that has to do with mental health. And we're trying to understand a lot better how extreme weather events, changes in food resources, disturbances to the well-being of a community or the sustainability community are being experienced by rural Alaskan communities. So, as I mentioned, one of the challenges in remote, small communities in Alaska, and remember that about 60% of rural Alaskan communities have a population of 300 or less. So we're really talking about neighborhoods, and from the standpoint, for example, of statistical significance, it's very hard to achieve something that is defensible. But it's also sometimes hard to find good weather data. And if you don't have good weather data and you don't have weather data that's been going on for a long time, you also won't have good climate data. But there are examples of really excellent weather data and climate-related data in different places around Alaska. And one of my favorites is the Nenana Ice Classic. And here is a picture at the classic where, it's been done the same way for almost 100 years, using the same methodology, and the data's all been collected. And when you look at it, it provides a beautiful example of a local climate resource. So what we have is the time frame between the 22nd of May and the 17th of April when the ice has gone out over history since they first started doing the Nenana Ice Classic in 1917. And as you see, just like you see in changing temperatures in weather, the date when the ice went out has a lot of variation. But when you look at a trend line, you can see that up until 2009, and comparing back to the first time they did the Nenana, you're seeing that it's happening earlier and earlier. So when we start doing a climate and health assessment in any community in Alaska, we look for these kinds of climate resources. And this is an example that we got from Kotzebue from National Weather Service. Now, Kotzebue is a hub community. They have a fairly long established weather station there, and a very good weather station, but you can still see that there's these gaps occurring in the climate data. So when people who are climate scientists put these together, they have to make some leaps. But it isn't until about 1950 where you start seeing consistent annual average temperature data. But what we do see is from 1950 to the present, where you are seeing an increase in temperature. And that information in itself is important. We pretty much understand that that's occurring all across Alaska. But what's more interesting is when you start getting into the details of as far as what happened in specific years and what happened in specific seasons. So in Kotzebue, and this is different than you will see in other parts of the state. There are so many different climate zones in Alaska and even microclimate zones. But you see that in Kotzebue, there is some really significant increases that's happening seasonally, in particular in the winter. That's a lot of increase between 1949 and 2006. Now, in the fall, you're only seeing 1.5 degrees. But not to sneeze at 1.5 degree temperature change, because, of course, it all depends, as Dr. Demain said, on your reference point. And if you're and how close you are to some sort of a biological or systematic tipping point. So if you're at 30 degrees or 31 degrees and you're seeing an increase of 1.5 degrees in the fall, that can be significant. And it's the same for many other types of biological systems as well. So again, the reference point is a big factor in understanding how significant temperature change is. And this is the region that we're working in right now. We're working with the borough and with the health organization in the region to try to define and profile a number of these communities comprehensively as far as what sort of impacts and what kinds of effects are occurring. And in this region, it's an interesting part of Alaska in the Northwest. You have the Arctic Circle crossing through the middle of the region. And you really have two major categories of communities. You have coastal communities and you have river communities. And if you look at some of the major categories that I talked about, type of water supply, type of food source, type of lifestyle, we can divide these communities up and we can even draw some conclusions and some generalities about what might be different between them. But mostly, just for taking water for example, Point Hope is the last community as you go up the coast, or actually it's the first community as you go up the coast that relies upon a tundra pond as its water supply. Everything north of Point Hope relies on a small tundra pond perched on permafrost for their drinking water. That's very significant, and you'll see why. These are surface water sources. You also have a lot of communities in the Northwest Arctic that depend upon river water sources for their drinking water, and those experience different kinds of climate impacts. And then the well communities that are further in the mountain areas, there's only a few of those, have their own challenges as far as changes to their water source and supply. But one common issue that is faced by all communities in the Northwest Arctic is that they are underlain by permafrost. Now, just to revisit a definition of permafrost isn't always a great big ice wedge like this, but it does have to be frozen. It can be frozen soil. And as long as it's been frozen for 2 years consecutively, it meets the definition. But when you have a tipping point in temperature, which is occurring broadly throughout the region, you see how the thawing of great big masses of ice like this may affect communities. Now, this is going back to some of the snap projections that Dr. Demain was talking about that were generated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks and also by their Geophysical Institute. And I think Vladimir Romanovsky up there is the real source for this information. But he has a whole time series looking at projected permafrost change around Alaska. going to 2100. And I just borrowed a couple of these slides, but what I'm going to do is just sort of click back and forth between them. And what we're really looking at here, of course, is soil temperature from 1980 to 1989. And what I'd like you to focus on at first is up here in the north, because the darker the color, the colder the soil. And of course, everything that is red here, it does not meet the criteria for permafrost because of temperature. And you just start to see, going up to 2009 and back, that we already have some warming trends occurring without even looking into the projections into the future. And also that you have this warming trend occurring into from south central up into the interior. So we know that there's a lot of change. It's already occurring as far as soil temperature, and that's going to affect permafrost thaw rates. So here's the community that we're focusing on for this presentation. It's Point Hope, Alaska. It's an Inupiat community. In fact, the whole Northwest Arctic region is Inupiat. They rely on primarily a sea mammal-based diet and upon the ice-based hunting. It's a very old community. The name in Inupiat for Point Hope refers to a pointing finger, and it goes back to as far as 400 BC is when it was first when the remains were first documented there. So, why do people go here? It's an amazing location. You have this promontory going out into the Chukchi Sea. As the sea mammals are working their way north, they have to get pushed around this point. It provides a wonderful opportunity for hunting. You also have protected inlet, and you have fresh water sources, and you have a nice river here for fishing. It's really an amazing area for subsistence harvest. But it's also very exposed to the elements, and very susceptible to the effects of current, of north wind, of ice, and of erosion. So this is really a, like many of the spits and barrier islands going up along the Chukchi coast, this is a landmass that is in motion and is changing rapidly. So when we're in Point Hope, We look for those key observers who really have, you know, the best level of knowledge about the changes that have occurred both in the long term and in the short term. And Joe Tuxia here is a retired whaling captain. And he not only remembers very clearly and is very articulate in describing the changes that have happened in his community, but he also has been writing them down every single day. And he carries here in his breast pocket, he's got his pen, and he goes out for walks and he writes down observations. And he was able to flip back to the early 1960s in his flip notepad and show me times when there were interesting events with polar bears or with ice or when different invasive species were seen for the first time and things of that nature. But we don't just talk to the whaling captains. We also talk to other people who have some special insight into those five different categories. That might be a nurse practitioner, and we certainly talk to all the health staff, but it's also the emergency response personnel. It's the water operators. It's the environmental health people who work in the tribal or in the borough offices. We try to talk to as many people as we can, and we ask them that same basic question. What are you seeing that you think might be related to climate change? And what are you seeing that is affecting your life, your work, and your health? And the type of information that they provide back to us helps to lead us back to the proper researchers and the proper data gaps that we need to follow in more closely to understand what the health effects are. But what Joe was most interested in had to do with changes to the ice. And, of course, I hadn't been up to Point Hope before, so I had to receive a little bit of an education myself. But, you know, in the spring whaling hunt, you're actually leaving the village, you're going out on the ice, and you're setting up your life out there for an extended period of time while you're watching for whales, and you're setting up your camp. And so in the recent past, Those camps, the thickness of the ice was measured in feet, and sometimes as much as 9, 10, or 12 feet in recent memory. But now the thickness of that ice is being measured in inches. And it's a very interesting to hear people's observations about being on that ice and camping when it's no longer a stable platform, but it's a moving, flexible platform. It's very and results in a lot of anxiety for those hunters. In fact, the breaking off of shore ice and going adrift is not a new phenomena, but we're afraid that it might be a more common phenomena, or that the ability to camp on the ice may be lost entirely in the near future. But on May 8, 2008, that's exactly what happened. The ice broke free, and it took about 30 different individuals and various whaling camps out to sea. And only because they have a really sophisticated emergency response system as part of the North Slope Borough were they able to send in helicopters from Barrow and actually pluck these guys off the ice and rescue them. So the ice is very, very important for the hunting culture, but it's not just from the standpoint of safety and as of a platform, but also from the standpoint of how to butcher and manage the whale meat once it is harvested. So that's the next thing they, once a bowhead whale is taken, that's the next thing these guys are looking for is, where am I going to cut this thing up? Because cutting it up in the water is inefficient, it's not good for the whale meat, it's not good for the blubber, and it's time consuming. And you don't want to be out there on the water any longer than you need to be. But again, we have the same problem. They're having a lot of difficulty finding some place where they can set up the proper anchors and where the ice is actually strong enough to pull up the whale onto the ice, not to mention bringing your family and members of the community out to help you to do that. So here's some of the climate change impacts from sea ice, and here are some of the potential health effects. Sea ice has been forming later in the fall and departing earlier in the spring. There are more ice-free days. The thick multi-year sea ice is being replaced by thinner first-year ice. Health effects. Injury from unsafe ice conditions. They haven't recorded any. We think there's a vulnerability for this to happen, though. But we do hear from all parties, including the whaling captains, that they're having to implement new safety measures to prevent bad outcomes. Changes anxiety due to increased risk, changes in environment and resource availability, food insecurity, and the potential for chronic disease if healthy food alternatives are not established. So this gets into the chronic disease piece. If you do not have whale meat in your freezer or in your food cellar, what is there instead? And if what is there instead is something that is healthy, then we're not so concerned, because hopefully it's a traditional food, hopefully has the same kind of exercise and lifestyle and cultural components. But if it's not, if it's something that is an unhealthy food, we become very concerned about things like heart disease and diabetes. Okay, one other issue with sea ice. In communities that are very exposed, not just up in Point Hope, but even down on the Aleutian Chain, the communities that are at a low elevation rely upon their own manpower and ingenuity to create a breakwater in the event of false storms, and they rely upon the development of shore ice to create a buffer. This is a picture that was taken in November of 2009. There is no shore ice on the shore in Point Hope, and that berm extends for miles. They spent all summer with a bulldozer building this berm so that when the winter storms came, they'd be protected and they wouldn't flood. But that was assuming there would be also a layer of ice that would be providing extra stability. And at this point, the person that built that berm was very, very nervous, and another person who was very nervous was the water operator. Because the water operator understood that if there was a wind in the right direction, the wall would be breached, the floods would come across, and their drinking water pond would no longer be fresh. So a lot of these things are connected. They're not necessarily new issues, but because of climate change, they become more serious issues. This is a picture, another erosion issue. We're looking at a near the coast, a river system. This is on the Woolock River, actually, which is a little bit further south. But this is an erosion event that's happened July of 2009. It occurred only over the course of about a month and a half. And this is one of those tipping points I was talking about. This is ice-rich permafrost. If you were to look under this hole in this crack here, you would see about a 6-foot in diameter tunnel that goes back underneath the bank this way. And that's where a wedge of ice, you have ice wedges that form along these rivers, where a wedge of ice had rapidly, because of changing air temperature and water temperature, thawed. And when that happens, and when the soil loses its structural integrity, you can get a lot of erosion and then you get a collapse. So what does this mean from a health standpoint? Well, I see three things here. Actually, I see four. One thing is that here you have tundra. Over here you have willow. This was like this. I mean, this was like this about 10 years ago. And this is what Dr. Demain is talking about, is that you're getting rapid growth of deciduous trees. I don't know what that means from a pollen and allergy standpoint, but I do know what it means from a wildlife standpoint. And that means porcupine, and it means beaver, and it means moose. And moose can be a good thing. And even beaver can be a good thing. But beaver in communities that have never dealt with Giardia and are not used to having to boil their water at fish camp is a new health concern that we have to make sure people are aware of. But what it does mean is when you're traveling up a river like this at a very high rate, because it's very shallow and you're up on step, and you come around a corner and there's a floating island of turf, it's certainly an injury risk. And so this is where you get a lot of good communication within the village, within the community. This kind of collapse is occurring, and there's a safety issue, and we have to be careful when we're traveling. This is another example of a much bigger collapse. There are about 1,000 of these sinkholes that have been surveyed in the Northwest Arctic Borough. This is one of the biggest ones. It's called the Selwick Slump, and it's upstream from the Selwick River. And again, you see some new kinds of vegetation establishing themselves here, but you also see this blue icy content or layer. That's the permafrost. And I haven't been to this site, but Yuri, who was there, told me that standing here, the tundra was actually caving off of the edge of this like a glacier. It was just floating off the top. So that's a lot of sediment that goes into this river. And again, it raises questions about navigability of the river, especially when you rely upon that for getting your supplies in and out. It raises questions about fisheries resources and spawning habitat. And it also raises questions about the water treatment plant in the village of Selwick, which is downstream. And they have to worry about all this increased turbidity and what it's going to do to their little sand filter and their little chlorination system. So permafrost, thaw, and erosion. Climate change impacts. Point Hope is currently at risk for seasonal storm events. Sea level rise and coastal erosion is increasing the risk. Will they have a flood problem? We don't know. But I tell you, if they run out of the resources in order to keep building berms and to hold the ocean back, then they're going to have problems. Risk of injury during a flood or evacuation is a potential health effect. Injury or disease afterwards if conditions are unsafe or if critical infrastructure is damaged and services are disturbed. Basically, what we're getting there is you lose your water plant, you have some kind of a disaster that occurs, the chance for infectious disease is one of many issues that becomes a big concern. Just a couple of more permafrost issues. As I mentioned, Point Hope and all of the villages located to the north, that means the whole North Slope borough, rely on these kinds of ponds for their drinking water supply. And they're very shallow. And everything north of Fairbanks in Alaska is actually arid. It's a desert. In fact, Fairbanks and everything north gets less precipitation than Tucson, Arizona does. So it's always kind of curious why we have all this water up there. Well, we have all this water because we have permafrost, and the snow melts, and the permafrost holds all that water in place. But as the active layer of the permafrost is thawing down, it provides a pathway for the water to leach out. And when it leaches out, they dry up. And so this is sort of some of the precipitation change, some of the drying effect that Dr. Demain was mentioning. And it's a big concern if you rely on these kinds of resources for your water, and also if you rely upon those kinds of resources for your food supply. So this is the water. This is the water supply in Point Hope. It's a small tundra lake, and they have a pipeline that runs 7 miles out down towards the point to a huge water storage tank. And these guys, from the moment that the ice goes out in that pond until the time it freezes up, the clock is ticking. And they have to get all of that water pumped and treated and chlorinated and stored so that they can make it through the winter months. But in 2007 and 2008, some interesting changes started to happen to their lake, which interrupted this process. So the water comes in, and they have this bank of filters here. And inside each filter, there's a bag. And the bag is a pre-filter before it goes into the rest of the filtration system in the water treatment plant. And usually, Andrew here has to take these. They run 24-hour shifts for 3 months straight. He has to take these out about 4 times a day and clean out all of the solids and debris that are in there. 4 times a day. It takes about 40 minutes, 10 minutes per stop. But in 2007, they started to have to do this more and more and more and more. So when I talked to them, they said, we're having this terrible problem with our source water quality. And so this is when we had to go back to the climate data. We had to find those local records and try to get an idea of what the water temperature has been, actually air temperature here, has been in the past and what it is in the present. And this shows during the prime treatment month, which is July, from 1924 to 1954. Here we have the days of the month of July. And what we did, because Andrew told us he thought the major problem was mosquito larvae, we went ahead and we put an indicator line at the temperature that's critical for mosquito larvae survival. And we wondered how many days was the air temperature above the required level in order for there to be mosquitoes. And as you can see, it's not until the middle of the month, and it's not very much higher than 46 degrees through 1954. But if we jump up to 2007 and 2008, we get another picture of how dramatically the temperature is changing in some of these communities, because you get temperatures above 46 degrees right at the very beginning of the month, and they're getting up much, much warmer, up to 52 degrees. So is that a tipping point? Well, we think so. We think that this is changing the ecology of the lake. And when we went and sat down with the water operators in Point Hope and looked at their logbook and then graphed the number of times that they had to change their water filters from a normal amount of maybe 3 or 4 times to what was actually happening in 2007 in blue and 2008 in red, you can see that they were really, really dramatically impacted in the operation of that system, where they were actually changing water filters up to almost 50 times every 24 hours. That means instead of spending 40 minutes doing maintenance on their filters, they were spending 8 hours. The water system was grinding to a halt, and it was because there was warming occurring in the lake, we think, and because there was changing as far as the ecology and more algae and more mosquito larvae, something's happening. So obviously there's some sampling that needs to be done and some monitoring that needs to be done, not just what's happening in the treatment plant, but also what's happening in the source water lake. So climate change impacts, low precipitation and high temperature and high evapotranspiration during the summer of 2007 and 2008 contributed to decreased water quality at Seven Mile Lake. health effect, an increase in organic material in the raw water, fouled filters, and interrupted water-making operations and created unnecessary utility costs. This is a big, big deal, folks, in communities that only have 600 residents to pay for all of that water, all that labor, all those supplies. So we see operations and maintenance and costs, the economics of running a small community, just as important for health infrastructure as we do things like disease. Okay, just one more example here. When you harvest a bowhead whale and you're expecting to use that meat and muktuk for a whole year, you've got to have a really good way to store it. And so here we have folks on the ice, and they're cutting up pieces, and they're going to transport it back. They're going to by sled and so forth. And what they have done traditionally and always is used the efficiency and the temperature of the ground to keep that food frozen. And I say frozen because it's very important. Inside these traditional ice cellars, the temperature is below freezing all through the year. So if you harvest a whale in April and you put it down in the ground, it's going to freeze. And when you go down in July and take a piece out, it's going to be frozen. That was the situation until about 10 years ago when things started to change. And now there is not a single food seller in Point Hope that is still frozen in the summertime. This is a huge challenge because when you put your meat in, it's not going to freeze. It's going to be in a refrigerator. And it might be a wet refrigerator because you get a lot of moisture in those food cellars. So all of these whaling crews are having to deal with this food security problem. I don't have graphs showing climate data on soil temperature in Point Hope, but I do have this from Kenji Yoshikawa at UAF showing what's happened as far as soil temperature in Barrow, Alaska, our furthest north community, from 1924 to 2009, and what was happening at different depths. So as you can see, at all depths, there is this upward temperature trend occurring. I was in a, there's a number of communities that is concerned about this on the North Slope because they're whaling communities. And I was in Barrow in January, on the 7th of January, and it was about 4 degrees below zero on the surface. And down in some of the ice cellars, there was standing water. We went down and there was actual standing water in the cellars. Others were frozen and were doing just fine, but some of them were not performing adequately. And we think the reason for that, and there's going to be have to be more study into this, but we think the reason for that is once these thaw out, it's really hard to get them cold again because they're insulated too, you know, once they're down the ground. Okay, and here's what a food cellar is supposed to look like in the spring when it's been cleaned out and it's ready for whale. And here's what happens when you start getting a lot of water movement, a lot of drainage, and a lot of freezing. It becomes an environment that it's not only is the food wet, but it's here it would be encased in ice, but in, certainly in the summertime it would be wet and thawed. So, climate impact. Thawing permafrost is undermining food security by increasing the temperature in traditional cold cellars. The potential health effects. Inadequate storage condition is resulting in spoiled meat and blubber, and may be increasing the risk for foodborne illness. And the reports we got from some of the clinical staff in Point Hope that they were seeing increases in the spring of people who were hungry, especially elderly, and people in cases of anemia. They didn't know why, but this is the response they gave us. This is what they were curious about when we started talking about food insecurity in these food cellars. So I'm going to stop right there. Again, these were the five different categories that we look at in our community assessment process: disease, injury, mental health, food safety and security, and infrastructure, water safety and security. We think that there is evidence that all of these different areas are being impacted in the community of Point Hope. And I'd just like to stop there. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Mike. I've known our last speaker since the late 80s and early 90s when he and I were both attending St. John's University in Minnesota. Dr. Joe McLaughlin is the state epidemiologist for Alaska and chief of the Alaska Section of Epidemiology. He began his career here in Alaska as an epidemic intelligence service officer with the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention in 2001. After completing his two-year fellowship with the CDC, he was hired on with the Alaska Section of Epidemiology in 2003. He completed his medical school training, at the University of Minnesota and a master's degree in public health and tropical medicine at Tulane University, and had his residency training in preventive medicine at Emory University School of Medicine. He's an assistant professor with the University of Alaska's Master's in Public Health program and a member of the Alaska Area Institutional Review Board. He's also a member of the Delta Omega National Public Health Honor Society and was the recipient of the Rising Star Award by the American College of Preventive Medicine. As an epidemiologist in Alaska, he has led numerous outbreak investigations, published a number of peer-reviewed journal articles on various medical topics, and has been invited an invited speaker at many national and international conferences. His recreational interests include whitewater kayaking, rock climbing, mountain biking, hiking, and backcountry skiing. And please welcome Dr. Joe McLaughlin.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. I will be speaking to you all about the potential impacts of climate change on infectious diseases in Alaska. So on July 16, 2004, the Alaska Section of Epidemiology was notified by the Department of Environmental Conservation of several cases of gastroenteritis among passengers of a cruise ship, and we'll call this Ship A, that sails in Prince William Sound. So on July 19th, we received a call from the Nevada Office of Epidemiology, and they reported a Nevada resident who became ill on July 4th and tested positive for Vibrio parahemolyticus. And Vibrio parahemolyticus is a bacterial is a bacteria that causes gastroenteritis, or basically stomach cramping and diarrhea. The passenger reported eating raw oysters on July 3rd while sailing on board Ship A. And Ship A is a 143-foot vessel that has a maximum capacity of 78 passengers. So on July 21st through July 23rd, the Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the U.S. FDA staff were on board Ship A, and we performed a retrospective cohort study to determine the burden of illness and risk factors for illness among cruise ship passengers. Additional case finding was also performed in Alaska to identify other cases in the community. So in results, 132 of 189, or 70% of passengers, were interviewed, and only raw oysters were a significant predictor of illness. A total of 62 cases were identified across Alaska, and 82% of ill persons reported eating Farm A oysters. Now, this figure shows the number of cases of Vibrio parahemolyticus gastroenteritis by date of onset. And again, the total was 62 patients. The rectangles that are in blue denote lab-confirmed cases, and the rectangles that are in yellow denote clinical cases. And the hatch marks that you see denote case patients that consumed oysters that were traced back to Farm A. This figure shows the mean daily Farm A water temperature by date and the number of Farm A-associated case patients by harvest date of consumed oysters. The red line here shows the temperature at Farm A, and this is June and July. And the green dashed line here shows the theorized threshold temperature above which the concentration of Vibrio parahemolyticus becomes high enough in oyster tissue to cause human illness. That's at 15 degrees centigrade. As you can see, all of the oysters that were consumed by case patients that consumed Farm A oysters were harvested at a temperature that exceeded this 15-degree threshold. This figure shows Farm A July through August daily water temperatures by year, starting from 1997 through 2004. As you can see, the red dashed line is at 15 degrees centigrade, the theorized threshold temperature, and 2004 was the only year on record during which the mean daily water temperature exceeded that threshold every day during July and August. So in discussion, this was the first documented outbreak of Vibrio parahemolyticus to ever occur in Alaska. Alaska waters were previously considered to be too cold to support levels of Vibrio parahemolyticus that are high enough to cause human illness. This expands the range of confirmed Vibrio parahemolyticus illness more than 1,000 kilometers north of the previously northernmost area with locally acquired illness. Rising water temperatures likely contributed to the outbreak. In 2002, the Institute of Medicine issued a report entitled Microbial Threats to Health, which examined factors involved with infectious disease emergence. In the report, a model was presented. This is called the Convergence Model for Infectious Disease Determining Factors. In the model, there are two key players, humans and microbes. There are the humans and there are the microbes. And there are interlocking domains of infectious disease determinants, including genetic and biologic factors, physiologic and environmental factors, ecological factors, and social, political, and economic factors. And then the black center represents unknown factors. Now, some specific examples of these factors that contribute to infectious disease emergence include human demographics and behavior changes, human susceptibility to infection, changing animal and insect vector ecology, mass production and globalization of the food supply, microbial adaptation, travel, and climate change. And if you look back up that list, starting from travel, you can see that it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to see how climate change could impact each one of these. Let's take a look at some examples of climate change-associated mechanisms. One that would contribute to infectious disease emergence. One is increased temperature. This can increase the replication rate of pathogens. It can also increase the persistence of the pathogen in the environment. And it can expand the geographic range of both the pathogens and any vectors that might be involved in disease transmission. Changes in local rainfall can result in flooding, which can lead to contamination, as well as drought, which can lead to concentration of pathogens. And finally, sea level rise can lead to flooding and infrastructure damage. So let's take a look at some potential Alaska examples. We'll take a look at foodborne, waterborne, vectorborne, zoonotic, fungal, and travel-associated diseases that might be associated with climate change. Let's start with foodborne diseases. A number of these foodborne diseases might be familiar to you. Some of them might not be. You can see at the bottom Vibrio parahemolyticus. We already presented an outbreak investigation that demonstrated the first outbreak of Vibrio parahemolyticus in Alaska that was likely associated with warming water temperatures. In terms of seasonal trends, enteric pathogen incidence rates often peak during the summer months. And inappropriate food preparation and storage is often implicated. Temperatures the week prior to illness onset tend to predict disease incidence. And that is displayed very nicely here in an article published by Kovets et al. In Epidemiology and Infection in 2004, where they looked at salmonellosis in 10 different European countries. And what they found is that when they tracked temperature, here the temperature, and they track disease incidence trends by week, what they find is the dashed lines here are the temperature trends, and the continuous lines are the disease incidence trends. The temperature peaks typically occur about 1 week before the peak salmonellosis incidence. Now, this study done by Fleury et al. In 2006 looks at Salmonella, Campylobacter, and E. coli infection, And the investigators examined the relationship between ambient temperature and weekly reports of confirmed cases. And what they found is that the relative risk of salmonellosis increased by greater than 1% per degree above minus 10 degrees centigrade. The relative risk of campylobacterosis increased by greater than 2% per degree above minus 10 C. And the relative risk of E. coli increased by 6%. Now, let's bring this a little closer to home. Here in Alaska, we have the highest incidence of foodborne botulism in the United States. And if you look specifically at the Alaska Native population, we've got the highest incidence in the world. The rate tripled between the 1950s and the 1990s, and changing fermentation methods likely played a role in this. The traditional fermentation method involved burying the food in the earth. And with the advent of sealable plastic containers, people started fermenting in these plastic containers, which not only create a much more anaerobic environment, which is favorable for this particular bacteria because it's an obligate anaerobe, but also it created a warmer environment because the fermentation occurred above ground, and oftentimes these buckets were baked in the sun. So we know that warmer temperatures promote Clostridium botulinum spore formation and toxin production, and therefore climate change could impact botulism incidence rates in Alaska. Paralytic shellfish poisoning is an illness that follows consumption of raw shellfish. The symptoms include gastroenteritis and paralysis. Shellfish concentrate neurotoxins that are produced by algal blooms, as you can see here in this red tide depiction here in the lower right-hand side of the screen. The incidence of paralytic shellfish poisoning could rise due to warming water and also due to increased precipitation of nutrient-laden runoff. We'll provide you here with a few waterborne disease examples: cryptosporidiosis, giardiasis, hepatitis A infection, legionellosis, and leptospirosis. I'll just go ahead and take a look at legionellosis. Legionellosis is caused by a bacteria called Legionella pneumophila. It's a gram-negative bacillus, and the transmission of this bacillus is through the airborne route, and people can also aspirate the bacillus. And Legionella pneumophila grows most efficiently in warm water. It can cause severe pneumonia, called Legionnaire's disease, and the incidence peaks typically during warmer months, and the risk appears to increase with rainy, humid weather. There are a few vector-borne disease examples that I'll provide here. Vector-borne diseases are diseases transmitted to humans by an insect or other arthropod. The examples I've provided include West Nile virus, Jamestown Canyon virus, St. Louis encephalitis, Western equine encephalitis, Lyme disease, and tularemia. Jamestown Canyon virus we already have here in Alaska. It's primarily in ungulates. I'm not aware of any human cases, but it certainly could occur. Let's go ahead and take a look at West Nile virus. West Nile virus, the life cycle of the virus is depicted here. The reservoir primary host is in birds, and there are 326 species of birds that have been identified by the CDC to be hosts for West Nile virus. And birds become ill by being stung by being bitten by a mosquito. And so mosquitoes are the vector for West Nile virus. There are 64 species of mosquitoes that have been identified by CDC to transmit West Nile virus. Humans and other animals are accidental hosts. The incidence peaks in the summer and the fall in North America. The symptoms are usually absent or mild. However, if the patient does have symptoms. The symptoms include fever, headache, body aches, and rash. Less than 1% of cases go on to severe disease, including meningitis, encephalitis, and sometimes West Nile virus can be lethal. West Nile virus infection is widespread in the lower 48, and the first documented cases originating in British Columbia actually occurred last year. warming temperatures might expand mosquito habitat and allow competent vectors to inhabit Alaska. I'm told that we do have at least two or three mosquito vectors that could potentially be competent vectors for West Nile virus here in Alaska, but more studies need to be done. This slide shows the spread of West Nile virus from 1999 through 2009, starting in the east up there in New York and making its way, making its way eastward. And you can see here, Washington State does have quite high incidence that was reported in 2009. Let's take a look at some zoonotic diseases. Zoonotic diseases are diseases transmitted from animals to humans. Examples provided here, Alaska examples include brucellosis, echinococcosis, giardiasis, rabies, trichinosis, and tularemia. We know that longer and warmer summers mean more northern animal migration and longer hunting seasons, both of which could increase the contact that humans have with these animal zoonotic diseases. The Alaska example I provide a little bit more information on here is giardiasis. Giardiasis is caused by a protozoan called Giardia lamblia, and this is an infection of the GI tract. It causes a diarrheal illness that follows consumption of contaminated water. And the beaver is a common host of giardiasis. And Alaska beaver have been shown to be moving north and northwest following the spread of aquatic and terrestrial food sources. Also, fungal diseases. Two examples that I provide here are Cryptococcus gadii and household molds. Cryptococcus gadii is an emerging pathogen in British Columbia and the Pacific Northwest that's found on trees and on soil. It causes pneumonia and can also cause meningitis and encephalitis or meningoencephalitis. And it grows in warmer, moist areas. And the spread of Cryptococcus gadii in British Columbia is continuing to progress northward. So we may, in the future, start to see Cryptococcus gadii in southeast Alaska. Household molds, Dr. Demain has already spoken about household molds a little bit, but certainly infrastructure damage and flooding can increase the risk of household molds. Another important thing to keep in mind is that climate change is happening all over the globe, and travel-associated infectious diseases can be imported. We're looking both at domestic and international travel-associated infectious diseases. And in Alaska, we have already started to see an increase in travel-associated infectious diseases. Okay, so how to prepare? Well, some of the things we can do, first of all, we can really strengthen our public health infrastructure related to disease, vector, and reservoir surveillance. We can also improve our public health outbreak response. We can inform the public and policymakers of climate change evidence that's occurring and things that we can be doing to prevent the impact of climate change or adapt to climate change. Issues around food and water safety, and also community-based monitoring networks, not only to monitor climate specifically, but also changes in ecosystems and the physical infrastructure. We can also improve interdisciplinary cooperation. Public health professionals, healthcare providers, veterinarians, environmental scientists, ecologists, geographers, economists, and so on can all work together to integrate available data and come to solutions together. And finally, research to predict the transmission dynamics of diseases, also to estimate the cost effectiveness of mitigation strategies, and finally, to provide a foundation for making laws and regulations. In terms of the state-level involvement in climate change, there is a climate change sub-cabinet that advises the governor's office on the preparation and implementation of a climate change strategy. And the strategy will convey state plans for adaptation, mitigation, immediate actions, and research needs. This slide shows the state of Alaska climate change sub-cabinet and coordinating bodies, and this this graphic can be found on the webpage, and I'll show you the web link in just a second. The governor's climate change sub-cabinet consists of commissioners from the Departments of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, Transportation, Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and Natural Resources. The State of Alaska Climate Change webpage can be found at www.climatechange.alaska.gov. And I'll finish with this slide, which shows a sample of partners working together towards adaptation planning at the local level. Thank you very much.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Mike Brubaker, co-founder and director of the Center for Climate and Health at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He was one of three Alaskan physicians who participated in a panel discussion on the health effects of climate change. The complete forum, including the director of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska, Dr. Jeffrey DeMaine, and state epidemiologist for Alaska, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, is available on our website at kska.org. Hosted by the National Wildlife Federation, the Health Effects of Climate Change Forum was recorded at the University of Alaska Anchorage on Tuesday, March 16, 2010. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.